Congratulations on your recent release.
Thank you.
And best wishes to you. It sounds like you've got a really bright future ahead of you. So
Thank
thanks
you
so much for joining us today on Prison Pipeline.
Okay, thank you.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
For this.
Ladies and gentlemen,
never been done to
work talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
KVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. Wanted to give a little bit of an update let you know that there's going to be the big Freedom Tour, bringing attention to the plight of Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of our longest serving political prisoners. His birthday will be in April, and folks want to use that opportunity to shed light on his case. Joining us this afternoon is Rachel Wolkenstein, his former lawyer, and you'll be part of that Freedom Tour. So welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much for having me here. Really appreciate it. And the Freedom Tour is going to be very, very important in the renewed or increased fight for Mumia's freedom. I mean, as you've already indicated, he's been in prison for over 43 years. He spent 30 years on death row, which is basically solitary confinement. And then he's been in general population for the past 14 years. But basically, his legal case in the Pennsylvania courts is coming to its conclusion, with Mumia still being in prison with no reversal of his conviction, which is totally manufactured, and Mumia is innocent. And I would say that the main point of this Freedom Tour that was been spearheaded and built by Mumia's oldest son, Jamal Ibn Mumia, is basically to concentrate and educate and to build, movement that is based on the fact that Mumia is innocent and framed. And that's really key here, because those two points have not been a sufficient focus of the fight for Mumia's freedom over the past decade or so.
Why have people avoided the conversation around framing, him being framed?
Well, I think in some ways it has a political root to it. Is that because it basically Mumia's lawyers at one point, and I think continue to some extent, are dealing with the fact, not dealing with the fact that the legal system in this country is biased racially, it's class driven, and that basically to talk about a frame up, which so many people are innocent and in prison, just huge numbers, millions and millions of people, is because the system itself is very, very biased. And there's no such thing really as justice, fair justice in any way in the American courts because of the way they're run. The racism is structural in it. Class bias is structural in it. And so therefore, it really is a frame up system to begin with. And I think people do not want to go head on and talk about that. A lot of the supporters and various people on the liberal bent are basically want to see a case that is sort of simply like one rogue cop or one bad DA, instead of understanding the systemic nature of the racist frame up system that exists in this country.
I can understand that. A lot of people have been brought up to believe that if there is any sort of injustice, it has to be an exception to the rule and not something that is baked into the equation. But with that being said, let's just focus on the framing aspect with respect to the time that Mumia was out and what was going on in Philadelphia. Whether it was the bombing of MOVE or the legacy of Frank Rizzo and so many nefarious actions attributed to the Philadelphia police, one would think that there would just be I wouldn't say an open and shut case, but a lot of evidence to dig through to see that if Mumia is being framed, if there's an entity that would do that, it would be the Philadelphia police. Why haven't we ever really seen a day of reckoning with them?
Well, that's a long story, but it has everything to do with the system that exists and the lack of a sufficient fight, recognizing, as I said, the basic intrinsic structural nature of the way the so-called criminal justice system works in this country. Now, in terms of what you're saying, this all comes out of Mumia's frame-up, all comes out very directly from the Rizzo regime, but not just the Rizzo regime. It has to do with the FBI and the FBI's COINTELPRO, which is counterintelligence program against the Black Panthers. And Mumia, people may or may not be really understanding or aware of, Mumia became a Black Panther Party member when he was 14 years old. And he was put on the FBI's target list called the ADEX file, targeted for being arrested and putting in a concentration camp when he was 15 years old. I mean, the FBI releases. I mean, I've been worked with Mumia since 1987, and I was in charge of all the investigation into the frame-up and everything during the first period of post-conviction appeals and proceedings from 1995 through 1999. So I'm very familiar with this history. So the point is, Mumia was targeted by the FBI. He was known in Philadelphia by the cops, the stakeout squad, which was basically the SWAT team, the so-called Red Squad in Philadelphia that went after and attacked the Panthers in Philly and stuff like that. Mumia was known because he was also part of a very highly publicized delegation at the age of 15 to go to Chicago to be a witness there after the brutal police and FBI shooting of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in their beds in their apartment. And Mumia was a delegate to that. He came back and he spoke at the very well-known Church of the Advocate in Philadelphia and spoke about how outrageous it was, how political it was, and everything like that. And so he was known in Philly from then. And then there was a front page article in the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1969 that had Mumia on the front, not 69, it was a little bit later than 70, that had Mumia on the front page, sitting, you know, on his desk in the Black Panther Party office as a kid. And that was known. And he was publicized for that and talked about all the fact that 38 Panthers had been murdered by the FBI over the past year. He said that. He talked about, he used the term political power grows out of the barrel of a gun, you know, quoting Mao, you know, which is very very familiar at that time. But also he explained right there in that article that that's the power of the U.S. government that has used its power, its weaponry, its murderous capacities to go after those who are, you know, indigenous fighting for their freedom, Black people fighting for their freedom. And he made that explanation of using that. So that was on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And so Mumia was very, very well known as a young Panther, as a really a teenager. And then he became, a few years later, he became a radio journalist. Like, he was heard all over the Philadelphia greater area. He was known and loved all over. And not only, I mean, he has this amazing voice and eloquent and all that and passionate, but he also spoke out about police brutality. He also took up the defense of the MOVE organization at that point. So became known, he started having dreads. And again, you know, a lot of people hearing this broadcast now do not understand that way back and then the only people who had dreads besides MOVE in the country were Rastas. It was not, you know, locks and dreads, braids were not a familiar thing, you know, that people wore, African-Americans. Rastas and MOVE were about the only people. So it was very noticeable when he showed his solidarity by not only having fair broadcasts about what the police were doing to MOVE, but also the fact that he showed that by his growing his dreads. So he was well known in both capacities. And within and the shooting of Officer Faulkner, now we're at like 1981, at the time that Faulkner was shot and killed in the red light area of Philadelphia, Center City area, there were three parallel investigations going on into corruption in the city by the mob, but also the police, the AG's office, Attorney General's office, shocked to learn as they were bugging a lot of these places that these meetings were happening, that police were involved in this, high-level police. So it became three of different parallel investigations into the corruption of the police in coordination with the mob. And all that was known at the time. There was an undercover investigation going on at that time. And this discovery happened. So at the night of December 9th, 1981, police officer Faulkner was stopped a small VW. In that VW was Mumia's brother, and he was stopped. It was sort of a provocation because Mumia's brother was also known to the police, and, you know, sort of just minor stuff, not political per se. And he was stopped. Police officer called for backup, which meant that he was saying there was more than one person in there. And what happens after that is there was some altercation between the cop going after Mumia's brother. Mumia at that point had been really drummed out of his, you know, very high level radio broadcasts and major stations in the city of Philadelphia, very well known because of his defense of the MOVE organization, because of his fairness in there. He was viewed as being biased against MOVE. And so he was basically drummed out of his very high profile radio broadcasts. So he was driving a cab. He had been almost robbed about a week before. He had, at the time, the night of the shooting, he was wearing a gun holster. He had a registered gun, totally, you know, legal and all that. He saw an event, something happening across the street where he was parked to, like, leave off a ride and pick up another passenger. Like I said, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. The clubs were getting out. Red Light District was a good place for to pick up, you know, new cab, you know, whatever. So point is, to get to your point, I know this goes on a bit long, maybe longer than, you know, people want to hear or you have time for, but the main point is Mumia gets out and he runs across this sort of parking lot that was there, and he gets shot by a police officer. He gets shot as he's approaching this scene by a police officer. And then he's on the ground. He gets beaten by 10 cops. Interestingly enough, at this simple stop here, within about, I would say, 1 minute, there were something like 14 different police cars on the scene with numbers of police there on the scene. And they see Mumia there. He's been shot. The police officer has been shot. And they start beating him up and throw him into a van. Within a few seconds more, the inspector, Giordano, and that name is very important, Giordano, who's third in command of the Philadelphia police at the time, was also Rizzo's right-hand man, who'd also been in charge of the stakeout squad going after the Panthers, who has also had been in charge of basically the entire neighborhood barricades against the MOVE organization in 1978. And they all knew Mumia. Giordano knew Mumia in every one of these different capacities and stuff like that. Giordano shows up very interestingly on this scene, and he sees Mumia's already in this van. He goes into the van and he basically, you know, hits Mumia again, you know, with his baton in there, beats him further, and holds off on taking Mumia to a hospital. But meanwhile, while he's there, what Giordano does is he's in charge of the radio communications to the central. He basically sends any other cop cars away from the scene, falsely tells them that the gun was in a car, the VW that had left the scene. So sending any other cops out of the way. And the punchline of this is that Giordano says, asked Mumia his report that was widely publicized the next morning and later in the early days of the case, that he said to Mumia, well, where's your gun? And according to Giordano, Mumia confessed and said, oh, I threw it on the ground after I shot the cop. Now, I mean, really, I mean, but this is what he said. And this became basically the sort of front page news about the case the very next morning, or that morning, as the press came out. And the press for Mumia was extremely favorable. I mean, here's a guy who was arrested on the scene saying that he had shot a police officer, and the shooting was supposed to be very execution style. The police officer lying on his back and the shooter firing into his face. That's the police scenario of what happened. And Giordano was like the main witness. And he testifies that Mumia made this confession. He testifies that Mumia's gun was right there. And that was, big news. Mumia was granted two things about how Mumia was respected in the entire city. Is he was granted in his first hearing after he was arraigned, was a $100,000 bail. I mean, when was the last time you heard of somebody, you know, a charge, especially a black man, being charged with killing a police officer and being allowed, you know, bail? And the headline, the Philadelphia Inquirer said, eloquent journalist is arrested for, you know, in charge with killing this police officer. It was an extremely favorable, amazing sort of headline, which reflected, you know, Mumia's, what people thought about him, including from the Philadelphia Inquirer, which had that headline in it. So getting to your other point, so what happens at the scene is that Mumia is arrested, his brother's arrested, but not charged as an accessory of the murder. Giordano, he brings a taxi cab driver who was in the area over to the van to identify Mumia. It turns out that taxi cab driver was not where he said. His testimony at trial didn't even say that he actually saw the shooting. He brings over a prostitute also to identify Mumia and that she had seen him run across the scene. No other witness said they even saw her on the scene. These are some of the background stuff from the scene. They said they never tested his hands for any gun residue and everything like that. That's probably not true. And it's certainly, you know, he was critically wounded. The point I want to make is Mumia was beaten and shot by police officers. And the evidence does not show, contrary to the prosecution's theory, that police officer Faulkner actually was the person who shot Mumia, which is part of the cop's scenario, the DA's scenario about it. And what becomes clear in the later investigation, you know, they say the police prosecution cases, Mumia confessed, there were two eyewitnesses, and they say that the gun that was used was consistent with Mumia's 38 caliber gun. Now, consistent for 38 caliber only applies to millions and millions of weapons. You know, there's no bearing on it. So what the investigation has shown and what has been denied, presented to courts, but totally denied by every single state and federal court it's been shown, is to show that Mumia is innocent and framed. And the frame up involves the fact that none of the evidence from the scene fits with actually even the ballistics reports or the medical reports or any of the reports from that night. It turns out that in the record, there are a cop who wound up, let me just take a little step back. In Mumia's trial, he thought he was facing Giordano coming in there to say that he had made this ridiculous confession. Totally false confession. And if the trial starts and Giordano's not listed as a witness. And before the trial started, Giordano was given the okay from Judge Sabo, who's known as the hanging judge, and who would basically sentence more people to death than any other sitting judge in the country at that time. And he had been given an okay, no violation of Miranda rights at all. And so he was going to testify, only he didn't show up as testifying. Instead, Mumia was presented on the day of his trial these statements from February. Mind you, the shooting happened December 9th, but from early February, from a hospital guard and also police who were there in the hospital when Mumia was brought there, critically wounded, and saying that they heard Mumia scream and yell, "I shot the MF and I hope he dies." Now, the doctor said Mumia couldn't even speak at that point. He was like, he had been shot, you know, downward through basically all his basic organs there, by his lungs, by his liver. He was, you know, had been beaten in addition to that. And so this was like totally crazy. And Mumia himself discovered that one of the cops that had this statement had, at the night of the shooting, he was one of the cops who had actually taken Mumia in the van to the hospital, said the Negro male made no comments. Mumia tried to get him into the trial to testify. They did that, and Judge Sabo would not allow that in. So these things happened at the course of the trial and the course of the further investigation, really starting in the early 90s and through, you know, mid 90s, that led to several hearings. We learned that the whole hospital confession was manufactured at a roundtable discussion of all these different cops who had been involved and possible witnesses. And basically the DA said, okay, did any of you remember any sort of confession? Does anyone remember anything that happened that he might have said? So they solicited this like really in the beginning of February, and Mumia was presented with this, you know, at the time of the trial. Now, what we learned later in many different ways is that we learned that from, I did a lot of investigation. One of the people I was led to, you know, talk to was a guy by the name of Arnold Beverly, and this was back in 89. And in 1989, he shared with me that he had been solicited by a police officer who he named, who was sort of a coordinator between the mob and the cops dealing with Center City, to be involved in a hit on Officer Faulkner. And the reason he said that was being happened is Faulkner was viewed as basically a danger to these cops in the area. And like I said, going back to it, I didn't know all this exactly at the time. There are all these investigations going on by the FBI, and they clearly had an undercover cop. And so more research led to the fact of believing there was not a document that says it, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, that Faulkner was quite likely that undercover agent working for the FBI.
I'm going to stop here for a minute because we're close to time. We've been talking with Rachel Wolkenstein, giving us some fascinating insight around the case of Mumia Abdul-Jamal, and really underscoring the fact that he was framed. Something, as she pointed out earlier, has kind of been downplayed and not really put to the forefront. I want to save you know, have you saved some of this stuff for when you come out here for the Freedom Tour, you know, when people can really hear you go a little bit more in depth? Can you tell us when you'll be out here? And
yes,
you know,
okay. So the Freedom Tour is the week of Mumia's birthday, which is April 24th. So we're going to be there, and I'll be there sharing, you know, very grateful to share the work with Mumia's son, Jamal. And basically be there from the 21st speaking through the 25th. And there are different events in Oakland, in San Francisco, and in San Jose, and I think something in Santa Rosa. So there's a whole week of different events in basically all different parts of the San Francisco Bay Area. So I will, you know, we'll make sure that we have the full list, you know, to you so that you can make other announcements about it and everything.
Yeah, most definitely. As we close out, what would you have people do? Is there one or two steps you would ask people to do to either familiarize themselves or maybe to help push the needle to leading to Mumia eventually being freed?
Well, I think the basic thing is for people to become educated or re-educated, as the case may be, on actually a lot of truths about Mumia's case have been sidelined, because those truths actually show the depth of the frame-up that was not just simply the cops. It wasn't just Rizzo. It wasn't just simply the governor. It wasn't the DA's office. It was also the Justice Department, because they knew that Giordano was a target in this investigation. Mm. They knew that. And they basically, every piece of evidence points to the fact they pulled him as a witness against Mumia because they felt it would endanger their investigation against the cops and the mob. But also, equally important, if not more, it would endanger down the road if it became clear that Giordano had been a target when this all happened, that it would underscore or overturn or be grounds for overturning Mumia's conviction. And the wow. only way that the DA at the time, who was Ed Rendell, who has been a big muckety-muck, you know, in politics in Philadelphia and actually in the heads of the Democratic Party. He was DNC basically chair for quite a few years. So Rendell is a major figure. So Rendell was the DA at the time that Mumia was prosecuted. And so what this meant is the AG's office, Federal Attorney General's office, had to have passed the word on to Rendell that you cannot or should not have Giordano as a witness in this case for these
wow.
reasons. And so that had to be there. Giordano, one last sentence about this. I know I'm running out of time, but Giordano did not testify, as I mentioned. But more importantly, we learned when we got a hold of his personnel record that Giordano had been removed as an inspector, third in charge of the Philadelphia Police, in February of 1982, at the same time that these hospital confessions were manufactured. And Giordano sat at a desk in the personnel office and left office, left being a detective, left being a policeman, on the day after Mumia was sentenced to death. On July 3rd, the next working day, he resigned right. from police office.
There is so much richness here, and we will definitely put the word out when you all come to town. We've been listening to Rachel Wolkenstein, Mumia Abul-Jamal's former lawyer. I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon on Hard Knock Radio.
Thank you.
Yes, and we will be in touch. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to talk to a good friend of the show. His name is Donald Lacey, fellow radio journalist. He's a comedian. He's an activist, organizer, the man who coined the phrase for the city of Oakland, love life. And one of the things about Donald Lacey, he does a little bit of everything. And usually we have him on, he's doing some sort of organizing in the community. Every once in a while we'll have him on and he's getting his comedic chops up to speed. But the last couple of times we've talked to him, he's been doing acting. He's been getting his thespian chops together. I like that word, thespian, you know. It gives the acting word a little bit more off. You know, you're not just an actor, but a thespian, you know. What is it, Shakespearean type of cat, classic. Yeah. Welcome to the show, brother. How you doing?
Oh, man, every day I wake up, it's a good day, man, and always appreciate it. But I got to say, man, I got so much great feedback when I had you on my show a few weeks ago to talk about our dearly departed brother, the great Dwayne Wiggins, man. That's some of the most feedback I've gotten in a while on the show, man. So they were particularly hype over the segment we did. So right on for that.
No, thank you. And we're going to do one on this side. We're going to probably do it after the funeral, but we have a couple of things in the can. We did one for Angie Stone. We did an incredible one that people will get a chance to hear on Roy Ayers. And you know who I had?
Huh.
I had Quadro Dutterville, you know, the Oakland Maroons, right? So, you know, he's a jazz guy.
Oh,
you know, yeah. And then, wait a second. I had Ursula Rucker and Jessica Care Moore, who were not only good friends with Roy Ayers, but both of them have recorded albums with him. So they were on at the same time. And man, that was just an incredible, it left everybody on a high note. And Roy, like Dwayne, you know, touched so many people. Everybody has a story, everybody has an interaction. And everybody feels like both of those, you know, individuals are kind of like belong to them, so to speak. You
right.
know, like you have people like, oh, Roy came over to my house and spent Christmas with me. And he was up in Harlem and he was living there and he's a New Yorker. And then, you know, you got Ursula. It's like, well, you know, the brother was hanging out with us over in Philly and he did all these things. And, you know, somebody from Detroit is breaking it down. And I think what the common denominator is that these individuals uplifted the art. They knew the history of their craft and they understood the function of their music. And music in a Western construct is usually something that you purchase and it's commodified and we go to watch you sing and, you know, and we get a value for whatever money, but with Dwayne and with Roy Ayers and with Angie Stone and, you know, and Frankie Beverly, who he lost, you know, these individuals on a whole nother level where they understood their music was a communal spiritual type of thing, you know, and, you know, we should not forget that. And I think we left off just really encouraged to keep, you know, the flames going and to build off their legacy. And remember them as folks that were very, very special. And so, yeah, I just had to say that. And I'm glad that we were able to talk and pay homage to Dwayne. And we will continue to do that because not one show can really capture all who he was, just like one show can't capture Roy Ayers or Angie Stone.
Yeah.
A lot of folks. But with that being said, you know, you're like you're blazing a trail yourself. And we had you on when you were doing a film short. You were playing like a laundry guy, a laundromat owner last time, right?
Well, actually, yeah, you did the voiceover for that.
That's right, I did. Yeah.
Butterfly Boxing, and I didn't know you were doing it until I went to the premiere and I said, "Man, that's Davey D," cuz everybody knows in Bay Area and around the country knows your voice on the radio. But I was playing this jazz saxophone player who used to frequent this laundry because old girl would kind of hook him up. But it was a real interesting character, man. And I had the great pleasure, one of my mentees, Archbishop King from the St. John Coltrane Church, he mentored me and taught me a few licks because, you know, I can't get on film acting like I didn't know nothing about the saxophone, but I didn't realize until he did like about 2 months with me, man, like a couple of days a week, 1 week, some weeks we didn't. But I didn't realize how difficult that instrument is to play, man. It was like, but you know, he made me serviceable, at least look like I knew what I was doing.
So you can play the sax now?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I can act like I could play it in a short film. That's about it.
Okay.
But I hit a couple of notes. He taught me to scale and taught me some basic stuff, you know. And he's one of the first people when I was 19, 20, when I first met him, who really got me into Coltrane. I mean, my father would listen to Coltrane, but I was just a little kid. My dad would be playing jazz all the time. He was a jazz drummer. But when I really sat down with Archbishop, like in the early 80s, man, he broke it down why they call him St. John Coltrane, why they have a church, why his music is so spiritual, why his music is liberation music, why his music is metaphysical. He just took it to a whole nother level. So I got mad respect for Archbishop Franz O'Keefe.
I hear that. You know, as an actor, it sounds like you're doing what they call method acting, right? Like you're just not taking a script, but you're like living the part.
Man, it's the only way I know how to do it. And then conjuring up giants. Joe Rudolph, the founding father of KPO Radio and Archbishop King, were great friends. And he reminded me, the great Luis Saguar, who a lot of people know, who died of hepatitis years ago, great actor. He did movies with Robert De Niro. He was part of Campo Santo, the theater company I've been a member of for over 24 years. And he was all about being in the moment. But he did this play about his heroin addiction, and it was called Hotel Angulo. And that was actually the first full-length play I did at Campo Santo, I want to say in 2001, somewhere around there. But anyway, you know, and I was trying to get what that feeling is like when that needle hits that vein. So I know Joe, and I can say this, he's passed, and, you know, he's a tuber. He used to do heroin with Miles Davis. You know, they go back to East
St. What?
Yeah. So I asked Joe, I was like, man, I ain't going to shoot up no heroin, but I got to know what that feeling is like. So when I act like I'm shooting up, I can portray it. And he looked up, and I'll never forget, and he took his glass off. He said, it's like being in the serenity of your mother's womb. And that was all I needed to hear. And I could just imagine a baby in the womb and what that sense of calm, safety, just being in Shangri-La feel like. And that's what I played. So, yeah, man, you know, like when I did have a cocaine problem back in the late 80s for 2 or 3 years, I had a bout with the powder. We did this play that I wrote called Home Base about a tragic comedy about cocaine addiction. And but I knew that world. I knew people who died from it. I knew a pastor who was on crack later on. So for me, whatever it is, I'm just like this play now. It takes place in Edgefield, South Carolina. And I didn't know. I started, the writer gave me a book for research called All God's Children. And it's about the history of violence in America. And it's about this black kid from Harlem who is just murderous, but they trace his family's roots back to Edgefield, South Carolina, where they were lynching, maiming, murdering black people by the thousands. And even after slavery, you couldn't get, most of the people that did it didn't get convicted. So I try to get into that world of where this play, the Boiling, takes place in Edgefield, South Carolina, for my character at least, and see what that world is like and try to imagine what it'd be like to grow up with that kind of racist, murderous history as a backdrop.
You've done plays, obviously, but this one is a movie. Is it kind of walking a thin line when you're doing movies and you're doing that type of acting? Because the way I've experienced being on movie sets is like you might shoot the same scene all day long and you got to stay in character with the play. Sure, you'll do the rehearsal, but you know, it's one and done. You know, you got to nail the lines, you got to get it. And if you didn't, oh well, you know, you compensate for it. but then you're done. But, you know, movie, man, it's like, let's do that scene again. Let's do that scene again. One more time. Let's do the scene again. And, you know, I've heard people lose themselves in those characters after a while.
Yeah, man. And it's actually, I'm doing two things. What the film I'm doing is Jocelyn's film, The Masquerade, produced by 49er great, who I think should be in the Hall of Fame, Vernon Davis. That's April 1st at the Grand Lake Theater, the world premiere. And I play the mayor of this fictional city, and it's all about gentrification and changing face of Black communities and how we hold on, you know, to what's sacred, how we hold on to our community and still, you know, try to live in this ever-evolving corporate world. And written and directed by the brilliant Jocelyn Rose Lyons. And that's going to be at the Grand Lake. But the play that I'm doing is with Campo Santo at the Magic Theater. It opens April 2nd through the 20th. To answer your question, I was watching an interview just last night with George Clooney. You know, he's making his Broadway debut in the play about the newsman, you know, the guy, Good Luck, Good Night and Good Luck, that guy.
Right.
Right, yeah. And he had never done Broadway. And they were like, well, why did you wait? And he was like, man, I'm a film actor. It's like, you know, it's a whole different thing. There's nothing like live theater, even when I go to plays. I mean, I live and breathe this stuff. I just love the craft. But when those lights go down right before the first sound cue or the first light cue or the first word, there's like this really magical thing that happens to me. And I transport into this 3, 4, 5 dimensional realm of this world, right? And in Campo Santo, we only do real plays that are just particularly to move the needle forward for people of color, I'll say. That's our whole thing. And they're always world premiere plays. You know what I mean? So it's about something to hopefully make people think, feel, laugh, you know, love, listen, and all of that. So the beauty of live theater, man, you got to be right in that moment. You can't be thinking about your next line. I mean, good actors, you have to be tuned in with whoever the other actor or actors you're with. You have to be right in the moment, like we're in this moment. Whereas in film, you know, it's cut. Do it again. Okay, we're going to move the camera. We're going to get coverage from this angle. And you pretty much have to match the performance you did so that it'll cut. You know, you can't be your left hand in this cut and then now you're doing your right hand because cuts won't mix. So it's definitely a difference between film acting and stage acting. But there's a lot of film actors who can't do stage, but most stage actors can do film, if you believe that or not. Because it's a different animal, man, when you're in front of that live audience and you're right there. And I remember my first acting teacher, man, I've been quoting this dude so much. Dr. Elkind from San Francisco State, he said, audiences are geniuses. Here they come into a play for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, and you've rehearsed this same play sometimes for 6 months, maybe even a year. And they know, without even having read the script, when there's a false moment, there's a collective consciousness in the room. Even if they don't know the story, they know. So that's why theater is it by far the most challenging. But for me, that's where I learned the craft.
Did being a comedian help, or were you an actor first?
I was an actor first. And then I was sitting there waiting for that phone not to ring. I was like, my wife was like, hey, partner, you better do something else because that phone ain't ringing. So we actually started our own theater company. And that's how I got into stand-up comedy.
Okay.
Full Circle Theater Collective. We produced the first annual Bay Area Black Comedy Competition, which some of everybody came out of there. Mark Curry, D.L. Hughley, Jamie Foxx won 1 year. And I could go, anybody who was in black comedy, Cheryl Underwood, I could go, RNSJ, I could go on and on, all the people that participated in that. And then I got to host the first year, and that's how I was a fan of comedy, but I didn't really know the craft. But once I got up there and realized, I'd be like, man, this ain't as easy as people think it is. Getting back to that first acting teacher, he said, "The death is hard, but comedy is harder." That's what he used to say.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you know, I can, in the company of others, I can roast, I can cap, I can get a couple of good caps in. But it's a whole other thing when you like, I just pay $50, or nowadays, you know, my cost, somebody might have paid $300 or $400. I think when Chappelle was in town, it was $1,000. I paid $1,000. You better make me laugh. That's a whole other thing, man.
Yeah,
they just looking at you, man. You know, man. You better.
And in the, and where I came up out of the end zone in Oakland.
Oh, that's right. Ooh.
It wasn't just, I mean, and Cat Williams came out of there, Linnell, me, I could go on and on. Laura Hayes, Mark Curry, everybody came out of there, man. And the Oakland comedy back in the early 90s, hey, man, not only was it not being funny, you might get a beat down if you say
the end zone.
In the audience. You know what I mean?
End zone was a rough crowd.
Oh, yeah, man. If you wouldn't, everybody I know that cut their teeth in there have gone on to do pretty good because, hey, man, it was, you got 2 seconds to get it right. Or otherwise, once they turn on you, it's a wrap.
That was our Apollo.
Exactly. Exactly. I seen a couple people get beat down, too, though. Yeah. I'll just say that.
There was no Sandman there.
No.
It was Big Willie D, who was like, man.
And the great Marvin Upshaw, rest in peace, he just passed away last year, a dear friend, Gene Upshaw's brother. That was his club, man. And he ran it with Tough Love, man. But it was a great place to cut your comedy teeth, you know? So when I went to L.A. in the early 90s, you know, and I went to the Compton Ramada, and everybody's like, man, you went to the Compton Ramada? I was like, man, this ain't even the end zone right here. You kidding me? I've been to the end zone, player. And then L.A. comics, including the late, great Paul Mooney, started coming to the end zone. You know what I mean? Shout out to Rick Sullivan, who was the man who ran the comedy shows there, did a lot for black comedy, particularly comedy in the Bay Area, and he don't really necessarily get a shine. So, Rick, I hope you listen. And Rick Sullivan, any comedian worth his salt will tell you, he was like the Berry Gordy of the Oakland Bay Area comedy scene back in them days.
We've been talking with Donald Lacey, and Donald, you have a movie and a play, but let's talk about the movie. What is it about? And it's going to be premiering Grand Lake Theater, April 1st.
This is the third time I've had the pleasure to work with just an incredible woman. She's so talented. Jocelyn Rose Lyons, J. Alphonse Nicholson, who stars in P-Valley, put us together, man. He thought I would be good in the movie that you and I did, where you did the voiceover and I was Aunt in that movie. And man, there's just something about her gift. She's very spiritual in her writing, you know, very three-dimensional. Her directing eye is incredible. She knows how to get great performances out of her actors. And she's got incredible crew people. Her DP is amazing. But she's just a special talent. And she's one of the top, you know, women directors in the game right now. You know, she did that incredible documentary on our brother Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Stan, I don't know if you saw that. Did you see that? Mm-hmm. It was just amazing. Got nominated for an Emmy. So I'm just blessed that, you know, she sees enough of me to call me again to work with her, man. And I hope people come out and see her work, because she wrote and directed this, and she put her heart into it, man, and assembled a great group of cast and crew. And the film is really, really groundbreaking. And this play asks the question, asks the question, when has progress become detrimental, particularly to communities of color, where we lose, you know, buildings that should have been landmarks in the name of development, where, you know, things happen. And I'm trying not to give away too much because I don't want to spoil that part of it, but there's outside forces that come into the community and change it. And then people that have been there for years with these cultural institutions that mean so much to you and me are no longer there. You know, we've seen it happen. So many venues in Oakland and San Francisco we've lost. So it really raises that question. When progress and tradition collide, how do we as people still maintain our traditions and our culture, but still thrive in a modern society? And she brilliantly weaves the piece. And Vernon Davis executive produce, and they've been producing films and working together for a few years now. And he's also really good in the movie, and the cast is amazing.
Vernon's in the movie himself.
Yeah, he's done a few, man. Vernon, man, he's one of the most humble. He's also an incredible painter and artist.
I remember
meeting him on the radio when he was still, I think he was still with the Niners at that time. And he had this exhibit, man, and the work was incredible. But he's just just the most humblest, nicest dude you'll ever want to meet. But, man, yeah, I've been really blessed to work with the two of them, man. It's going down April 1st, known as April Fool's Day, 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater, the world premiere. Folks, you got it in the movie. I've just seen the trailer, but I was there while we were shooting. And of course, the performances are incredible. I'm really excited to see the finished product.
Well, I'm glad to see that Oakland is doing its thing with its arts. We saw Freaky Tales last week, and that was good.
I saw that, man. I mean, I didn't see the movie, but I saw the premiere.
A lot of people came out, and it started off in a way that you were like, huh? Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
It was good. You know, it came out really good and was like 600-700 people there. And hopefully you get a similar audience to come out for this one. Again, the name of the film is called The Masquerade, and that's going to be at the Grand Lake. Donald, as we get ready to wrap up, anything else you want to let people know?
Hey, man, you and I, man, we go way back, man, and we both have lost, you know, as we were opening this and you were mentioning all the luminaries, Dwayne and Angie Stone and Roy Ayers, and I could throw in Roberta Flack, and even we've lost so many just great artists, great keepers of the culture. But man, what a tradition that we have been, you know, be able to be part of, man, as journalists, as artists myself, and be involved and just see all the people, man. I'm just feeling really blessed, man, because you know, Dwayne was just a special human being. And the same with Roy Ayers. I had the pleasure to open for him at, you remember Velma's? He did some shows over there in San Francisco. And the brother was just, and he was spitting some game amount about history, Black history, and oh my God, just an incredible human being, man. So, you know, I just say to everybody listening to this, man, keep supporting Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, KPFA, particularly with everything that's going on in this country right now. We really got to support our alternative media sources. And brother, I just want to give you your flowers, man. You have been, not just because, you know, you've been supportive of me, but you've been supportive of so many artists, so many activists, so many movements in the city, man. I just want people to really take the time to appreciate you, man, and say thank you to you over the air, brother. For, again, not just for supporting me, but supporting everything that you've done and giving a platform for people like me to come on, man, and talk about what we're doing.
Well, we appreciate you, Donald Lacey, and thank you for the props. Ralph for now. Peace.
Power to the people. my juggler, natural hustler. Think I need a smuggler up in Russia. You could be my butler, shine my cutler. Shout out to Oyenda, that's the guzzler. Okay, next thing, my life is a wet dream. I call it a sex scene, the bag is a nice tease. I tried to escape, my life is an x-ray. I'm sorry, a sex tape, you only get one tape. Quiet on the set, please. Rolling anxiety in 3, 2.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, founder of the World Ocean Observatory. Where I live, come spring, we enjoy a special season of the year, mud season, a time when all the moisture, all the melt of ice and snow that has saturated the land, especially the roads, transforms solidarity into a terra aqueous muck. Land and water combined, neither in its proper form, but mixed, neither one nor the other, a superfluous layer of admixture in which boots sink, cars become stuck, and the functionality of land and water as distinct forms is compromised as unnatural and impassable. Of course, the interrelationship of land and water is central to biodiversity worldwide, the mud banks where the crabs and clams hide, the layers of earth wherein live the worms and grubs and other subterranean creatures. Walking the land in other seasons, one may not be aware of the teeming life, the seeps of water, that wherein lie the basic life forms and systems that, when magnified, enable our gardens and fields, our ponds and streams, that amplify into the wetlands, rivers, and coastal connections that are so essential to our health, our economy, all aspects of our lives. Terra aqueous is the basic condition of earth, manifested in many different forms, degrees, and ecosystem services. Mud season is but an inconvenient passage along the way. Understanding this symbiosis is key to every step towards sustainability of biodiversity and life. In each moment, in every place, some balance of the two parts must be maintained. To do so, however, requires us to have the knowledge, the science required to define actions or to shape policy, to react to natural and man-made changes to our environment. When we deny or cease inquiry into these conditions, we choose to ignore reality as if we have decided to live in mud season all year round. Such things are easily evident on land, but the ocean has its counterpart, seemingly all aqueous, but mixed with many things from landside, streams of waste, plastic, poisons, debris, erosion, and other human detritus that is dumped into the sea to a point when, in some places, it too becomes a noxious muck in which we sink. It's easy enough to extend the dynamic condition to the human body. If flesh is land and blood is water, we are our own admixture, our own terra aqueous being. The maintenance of life, yours and mine, is a basic human aspiration. We punish those who take it from us. We fight the conditions of disease that corrupt and deny health and longevity. We grieve deeply when that life is lost. In some places these days, governments are declaring the sanctity of personhood of natural resources, sacred places, waterways, and cultural vestiges, recognized as collectively valuable to our society as our own. Some nations have rewritten constitutions, laws, rebuilt structures and institutions to assert such value, adopting the idea of admixture as a natural societal reality that should be reflected in our definition of best behavior. Oftentimes, as I write these brief reflections, I get caught in the muck of metaphor, but as rhetorical device, metaphor is a tool for clarity, correspondence, and understanding. We see things we cannot see by seeing something else that we can, and the realization is instructive. Terra aqueous is a condition not exclusive to either of its parts, but an inclusive, complex, and familiar fact of the natural and human world. We are both land and sea. Our mud seasons pass into the freshness of spring, the fullness of summer, the beauty of autumn, and the austerity of winter, as life cycles for flora and fauna, including ourselves. I revel in my two-part being. It pains me to see us deny such a basic fact of life. I despair as we take action to reverse what we know to be right, not for one interest or another, but for us all. I'm angry when I see the outcomes measured in human loss and community disruption. Is this just another iteration of mud season? Are we stuck in a cycle of singularity, selfishness, and incivility? Or is this just a changing moment, and that spring will come and natural balance will return? We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special